Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. It's Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and welcome to another episode of Be Unique's Unscripted, where we talk to artists, musicians, performers, and business professionals. My name is Tony Taylor. I'll be your host for this evening. You know, you could spend your Thursday nights anywhere, and we are excited you're spending it with us. The conversation is cool, it's calm, and it's casual. You can also be a part of the conversation by dialing 516-418-5651. Now, before we begin, let's talk about why you need to get on your phone and go to beunique.org. That's BUNEKE.org. Here's what Be Unique is all about. Our mission is to work today to change tomorrow using digital mediums to connect the world with professional storytelling and media production. We work to educate, inspire, and foster positivity and creativity worldwide through video, audio, and a spectacular literary magazine featuring writers from around the world. The newest Be Unique magazine is out right now, and you can read it online along with Be Unique Brevard magazine, the Space Coast premier magazine. Be Unique is also a media powerhouse. Not only do you get this incredible podcast hosted by me, Tony Taylor, but 11 other shows. So sit back, get comfortable, and get ready to dial 516-418-5651 with your questions, comments, and whatever else you may want to say. Let's meet our guest.
As my good friend Gomer Pyle used to say, surprise, 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 because I'm not Tony Taylor. I am Mary Brotherton. Tony is taking the night off because he's actually working a gig somewhere. He didn't tell me where, but he's making money, and hats off to him. Tonight, though, I'm excited because talking with a man who played cards with Darth Vader on a movie set, he's listened to Quentin Tarantino. I can only imagine the excitement of that. And you know what, folks? I'm going to tell you, Bill Richardson is a world traveler. He's crawled through the pyramids of Giza. I haven't been there yet. I'm probably twice as old as Bill and sat at home most of the time. But before the show started, Bill was going to tell me what he had done today. He's a writer, director, producer of films, and he's, you know, you could kind of get tired reading his bio. He's a widely acclaimed historian. His documentaries are used to teach at prestigious universities all over the country. He's a writer, he's a storyteller, and he was telling me a story before the show. So, Bill, would you take it away and tell our listeners what you did all day today?
Well, I spent the day today editing film. I've got this crazy idea to do a video book. It's a strange sort of concept, but I've got a book that I did called More Than Evil, and I wrote the book, and I did this really interesting audio version of it in which it's got a lot of sound effects, and you know, it's almost like the old-time radio stuff with all this really, really rich sound
design. I think
we're
going to listen to a little bit of that later on, too.
Yeah, we hopefully we'll have time for a little piece of that later in the show. And then I got this crazy idea to do a visual version of that book. And I'm still working on proof of concept to see if I'm going to be able to make it work. But I spent all last night shooting and all day-to-day editing trying to figure out if something like this would work. So it's not
so
a
sit
movie.
Sit back, get comfortable, and get ready to dial 516-418-5651 with your questions,
There's
comments, and whatever
machine.
Else you may want to say. Let's meet our guest.
Oh, I'm going to have to shoot that ghost. I got to get an exorcist going over here. That was weird.
People always want to ham it up and jump in. That's what happens.
Well, that's Tony. He can't stand for me to be doing the show without him.
And so this video book
well,
idea,
you know,
I think
that's got good proof of concept because they've done movies based on graphic arts, you know, graphic comics and graphic novels. I don't see why you can't do this.
Well, it's, you know, it's really, really time consuming. But I'm going to do the first 20 minutes of the book, which, the first 40 minutes of the book, which basically gets up to what movie makers call the plot point and writers call the inciting incident. And it gets up to the big, you know, twist that ever, you know, sort of locks you in there. But it's really, really time intensive. It's different than a movie because, this is a 6.5 hour audio book. So it's completely different than trying to bring the story down into 2 hours, you know, as a movie. So it's just something different. I'm gonna put it out there on YouTube probably in May, and it's just a way to get people to sort of introduce to the book, and you know, find different ways to get fans where they are.
Now, is that the book that you kind of took a different take on H.P. Lovecraft?
No, that's a new book called Hellfighters. This is an older book. It's called More Than Evil, and it's about these coal miners are, you know, miles back in underground, and they open this, they find this chamber that they open up, and it releases this sort of demonic force that begins spreading through the town, and the sheriff is the only person that can, you know, has a chance to stop this from destroying his town, destroying his family, and maybe getting out and destroying the world. And that's that book. And that's the one that the audio book is about as well.
Wow. Now, you, how long is your book? You mentioned that audio is 6 hours long. How long is the book?
It's around 300 pages. That particular book is about 65,000 words, which means nothing to most listeners. It's about 300 pages, which is about a little lower than your average novel. But, yeah, it's a quick, fast read.
Yeah, sounds like it. But it sounds like with the audio being 6 hours. Now, are we talking about the same book here that's 6 hours long?
Right. I don't know what the breakdown becomes
because
for that.
But you've added sound effects and such to it, right?
It is, but, you know, most audiobooks are between 8 and 12 hours long. So it's actually short for an audiobook. Yeah.
That's why audiobooks are great for road trips.
That's exactly right. I had a long conversation with Pup about this, Pup Duffy. And, you know, a lot of people have trouble paying attention to them because they're double tasking. And when you're on the road, it's perfect because, you know, you're basically on autopilot when you're driving. And you can pay more attention to the book. I'm getting ready for a road trip here pretty soon, and I'm saving up the books. Yeah, exactly. And I'm saving up the audio books that I'm going to listen to on my trip.
Yeah, my son and I used to, when he was a teenager, he had talk about growing pains. He had so many growing pains, he kept going back and forth to the doctor for various situations. And the doctor was an hour away, so we would always get an audio book. And we'd listen to it there. We'd listen to it coming home. Sometimes we'd sit in the driveway and just listen to the next chapter and plan our doctor's visits around the book.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons that I'm trying this video book concept is that you have to get people where they are and what they're into. And most of the people who read, honestly, these days are over 40. A lot of audiobook listeners are too. But all the younger generation are on YouTube, and that's one of the reasons that I'm doing something that can get out there and, you know, access a different audience and a different age group. But, you know, that you've got to figure out what people are into and meet them on their terms these days.
Absolutely, because if you don't, you might as well be in the 19th century trying to put your stories out in a serial newspaper.
Exactly.
People don't read them anymore.
No. And there, you know, that's the problem. So many options these days. But on the other hand, there's so many options these days.
Yeah. When we started Be Unique 4 years ago, I thought, okay, well, this is going to be something nice to do to occupy my time, where I can make a difference in the world. And it has grown and grown and grown. Like I said earlier, in 2019, we started the show. We had one show. Now we have 12 shows on the channel. And I think we're getting ready to bring in number 13. But we never had any idea that it would be so amazing. And then just people are giving us more ideas of what we can do every day. And we do what we can. We do the best we can. Pup and I were comparing our to-do list earlier today, and I think she trumped me because she's still in school, and she's got a 19-year-old kid, too. I don't have those challenges.
Well, I'm not in school anymore, but I've got a 16-year-old, so.
Well, there's a challenge right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I want to ask you the most important question that's been bugging me all day long. You played cards with James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
What game did you play?
Wow, that's been a long time ago. We were playing poker. And this is way before people were into Texas Hold'em and those kind of things. We were just playing straight poker.
Okay. I thought you were going to tell me Uno.
No. And James was on that particular film was a film called Mate One. And on that film, he was the big cheese. He was really the name for that film. And he had done, I think, at least the first two Star Wars films by that point. Maybe Field of Dreams, but he was the big name. But he, hung out with everybody on the set. He's a very proud guy. He's kind of reserved. He's very much like the character that you see, a little bit bigger than life, even though he's not, that large of a person. But it was just really cool that, he was, it was a real low budget film for that time, and he just hung around with the rest of us, and that was one of the reasons we ended up playing cards, because there was a lot of downtime when you're shooting a film, and he got bored like everybody else, and he jumped in to play with us.
That is one reason that I am not in the film. In a way, I'm in the film industry, but I dabbled in it, and I went to a few auditions, and I sat around on a few sets, nothing like anything you've worked on, but I just couldn't stand the hurry up and wait part of it.
There's definitely a lot of that. Yeah, there's definitely
a lot of
that. Well,
if you're an actor, you have to know your role, and you can't be off. I would think, poker would be something that you can stop and start when you need to, or something that's not going to be taxing your brain. But me, I would want to be sitting there editing my next story or writing something else. And I would not learn my lines, so it became kind of a non-starter for me.
The thing that folks don't realize that have never been on a movie set is that you shoot a scene three or four different times, same scene, or four different times. And there are two-hour breaks usually to move the camera and the lights and all that stuff between each one of those different times that you shoot it. So you've got an actor who does a scene. Then he has to wait 2 hours to come back and do the scene again. Then he has to wait 2 hours to come back and do the scene again. And it's very, very hard to match your rhythm and keep that energy the way that it was.
Uh-huh.
It's a really challenging thing to be an actor in a film.
It's real
completely
work.
Different than stage acting. Yeah. Yeah.
It is real
very
work.
Different than stage acting.
And, I've been on enough sets for various, usually my best option is to go and, work with the equipment and not actually be reading lines, because I'm too busy in my head. So the most fun I ever had was doing lights on a zombie film. And it was really fun because it was silly. But I've been on sets before where I had to, stand on this mark, and you just stand there for a while.
Yeah.
And, they don't want you to. And I get it because of what we've done with Be Unique, because we have a film production aspect as well. And I've been able to see it from a different perspective. And you don't want these people moving around. And in fact, on that same zombie film, one of my other jobs was to go buy up all the Tide sticks that we could get, because the main actor didn't bring a spare white shirt, and he got blood all over his first white shirt. So, you know, I was the props girl, the costume girl. But it's a lot of fun, but it's also, like you said, it's a lot of work to get it right.
And tremendous, and tremendous amounts of pressure.
Yeah.
And people
like
don't
anything that you
keep going.
I was just going to say, with anything that you want done, if you want it done right, if you're not going to take shortcuts, then it's going to take time to make it the way you want it to be done.
Well, you know, what you were just talking about is that it only takes one small breakdown to just kill a film. We're such a collaborative medium, and there's so many people doing so many jobs. It only takes, you know, one thing, like, you know, not having a spare shirt, to completely, you know, make everybody else's hard work go down the tubes. And it seems such like a small thing, but it's like that, you know, the saying, you know, without a shoe, a horse was lost, and then the battle was lost, and the war was lost.
Exactly.
And that's one of the reasons.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons there's so few really good films, is that it's really hard to make a good movie. I mean, you can be the greatest writer in the world, but if the actor doesn't bring it, then, you know, it's not going to work. And the same thing is true of the props and the lighting and the effects and all those things. You know, if one person doesn't, you know, bring their A game, it makes everybody else look bad.
One of my favorite things to do with a movie, and I don't care if it's a, you know, a blockbuster award winning or not, I love to sit back, you know, in the comfort of my home and check for continuity. And there are times, you know, with my husband and I.
People like you.
Sorry. Well, see, that's why you need to hire me to work with you before you finish it, and I can catch all that stuff for you. But, no, my husband and I will sit back, and we'll be watching a show, and I'll just tap him, and I say, pause it. Now, I got a continuity issue. He hates it, too. But I have to, you know, I'm sorry. Yes, a moment ago, he had a bloody nose. Now he doesn't have a bloody nose. And then 5 minutes later, he's got a bloody nose again. Or he's wearing a mustache. He's not wearing a mustache. He's got a pink handkerchief, and now it's a blue handkerchief. You know, make up your mind. Especially if they're trying to portray a specific sequence of events. And they just, you know,
and that's what I was saying
though
earlier, is sometimes those pieces were shot 2 days apart,
yep,
you know, and, you know, it's really, really difficult to keep all those little details straight.
And there are people in some of the higher budgeted movies that walk around with a clipboard for just such things. You know, they'll go back and check.
One of the lowest budget films I ever worked on, the number one person we had was the continuity director, who stood right beside the camera the whole time.
Yeah. Good. Now, I always have so many questions that they're competing in my head for which one to ask next. I want to ask you about Quentin Tarantino.
I was.
I can
at,
imagine a conversation with him is not so much a conversation as it is a listening party.
He has a machine gun brain, I'm telling you. Just like you, whenever you see him, he's sort of manic, but his brain goes 100 miles an hour. And I was in a gathering with him.
Most of his movies.
You know, the thing about him, you know, one of the things he's really known for is his dialogue. And, you know, I can just see that stuff. You know, he's a very verbal person. And, but he, you know, it was a situation where he was interacting with a lot of fans and that kind of stuff. And he was very, very generous for this time. It was at Sundance Film Festival. I was there for, had a film that I was promoting. And, his brain is going at 100 miles an hour when everybody else is going at, you know, 5 miles an hour.
I kind of thought that might be the case because his films are that way. You have to really pay attention And for a long time, I wouldn't watch any of his films. I watched one, and I saw his name up as the, you know, the producer, the director, the writer, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, ew. It was one of his gorier ones. I think it was From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
It was one of his early films, and it was just a little over the top for me. A lot of his films are. And the first time I watched Pulp Fiction. Yeah. The first time I watched Pulp Fiction, I thought, I'm done. Quentin Tarantino, I don't like you. Forget it. I don't like this anymore. And my husband was the one who said, watch it, but don't look at it. Just listen to the dialogue. And I'm like, oh, man, you sold me on this guy now. Because his dialogue is really impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that stuff is honed and polished. And, you know, he's definitely sort of a stream of consciousness person. But that's just where you start. You go back and edit and hone that stuff down to where it's just
absolutely
shiny as a new penny. Yeah.
So how long does it take you to write one of your novels? I'm not asking nonfiction because that's a whole other ball of wax.
You know, it really depends. I have one book that I'm holding on to that I've not released yet. It was the craziest thing. I got the idea for it by looking, I was at a Barnes & Noble looking at book names and was just spitballing and stuff. And I got an idea for a name for the book, and I went home that night and I wrote it in 10 days, which is ridiculous.
I love it.
Yeah. Normally, you know, now the edit and the rewrites and all that stuff took another year.
Yep.
for various reasons. But that book was just a total mind, you know, dump. And it's really one of the best things I've ever written.
I've never written one that fast. My first novel I wrote in the month of November, NaNoWriMo month. I'm still working on that. I may end up just trashing the whole thing and starting over. It's got a good premise, I think. But, you know, I wrote it. But my next novel that I wrote came about, it was triggered by a life event. And it wasn't a pleasant life event. I told my husband about it, and he says, you should write about that. I'm like, maybe I will. Well, the next morning I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it took me probably 3 or 4 months to actually write the entire novel. I'm on my third rewrite. Because halfway between first and second rewrite or whatever, somewhere down the line, I decided I'm going to turn this into an episodic. So I've got that done, and now I'm revising the novel based on the episodic, and I still have done nothing besides keep it on a file on my computer.
Well, you know, every project has its own sort of pace and its own life. I mean, a lot of times it takes me a year to write a book. You know, it's different for every project. The thing that most, you know, people who've not done these things don't realize is that all this stuff, it's hard. You know, a lot of people will sit down and read a book in 2 or 3 days that it took the author, you know, a year to write. So it's, you know, a lot goes into these things. And polishing them and getting them good enough for an audience is really the hardest part, and it's the most time-consuming part. You know, the actual first draft, sometimes that can come out pretty quickly.
Yeah, you're right, because I think a lot of self-published authors write one draft and go, okay, I'm done, and then they go pay for it and have it done. I have it printed, but nobody buys it. So if they would just take the time and revise it and polish it and make it nice and shiny, then people would pay more attention to it. Because I've got 2 or 3 photos on my wall. I'm such a nerd. I don't like to mark up books. I'm very protective of my books. But if I find a mistake in a book, see, you talk about my continuity, you hate me. Authors would hate me for this. I've got photos that I've enlarged, you know, like 16 by 20, where I laid a pen, a red pen, pointing at the mistake in the book. And I took a picture of it, got it printed out. It's on my wall now. Because I can't stand to mark up a book, but I can't stand to let that mistake go unnoticed.
Well, again, I really hate people like you.
Yeah, but you know what?
So out of 80,000 words, you found the one mistake. That's
uh-huh.
Fine right there.
But I've had writers tell me that if it wasn't for my editing, they would have stopped a long time ago and wouldn't be writers.
Well, I want to tell you something. Having a good editor is gold. It is gold because you just become numb to the things. You read them 5,000 times and you just can't see the forest for the trees anymore. And you need that person who's completely objective, has not been on the journey with you, to take that thing and take it apart and figure out what's wrong with it. That's one of the most valuable things that any writer can have.
And even editors need editors. When we think the magazine is ready to put, you know, release it, the first thing I say is, hold up, I'm going to send this off to Marion because she's our final eyes, and she'll find maybe, you know, if I think it's perfect, she'll find maybe 10 to 15 items. Sometimes she finds more. And it's, for me, it drives me crazy because, oh my gosh, there really should be a comma there. How did I let that Oxford comma not get put in the sentence? And people who don't know what an Oxford comma is would care less. And please don't let me review books because I'm brutally honest. If it's bad, I'm not going to tell you it sucks, but I will tell you how it could be better. But I think that's what most people want when they're getting their books reviewed a lot. But then there are people who just want the praise and the accolades.
Well, you know, reviewers, I've been fortunate. I've had some folks that have been very, very kind to my work. But one of the things that you find, you can take think about the best book you've ever read, your favorite book, and then go out on Amazon, and I guarantee you there's at least 5 one-star reviews of that book.
Oh, yes.
So there's nothing that's ever going to satisfy anybody. I had once got a bad review from a woman who didn't like the fact that I wasn't Stephen King. And I said, well, duh. Sorry.
I'm sure he is very grateful you're not Stephen King.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But, you know, nothing is ever going to satisfy everybody.
Nope.
And so you have to try to get it to your audience, the audience that will appreciate it, and then just go from there.
That's right. And speaking of going from there, I'm going to go from here to our quick little break, and we'll be back.
Have you ever read a web article on the internet that really spoke to you? No, I mean really spoke to you. Well, let me tell you about Newsly. Newsly is the new and incredible audio app made especially for iOS and Android. Newsly picks up web articles about the most trending topics throughout the entire internet. And at any given moment, Newsly reads those web articles to you in a natural human voice. Browse your favorite articles from topics you choose. Stop scrolling, start playing, start listening, and start learning. And Newsly has podcasts as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 40 countries. Our podcasts, Unscripted, Coffee, Candy, and Creative, and On Demand are there too. Go to www.newsly.me to download and use Newsly for free now. And if you use promo code BeUniqueRadio, all one word and with caps, receive a 1-month free premium description. For the first time in the history of the internet, the web becomes listenable. Listen and learn with Newsly.
Well, there you go, folks. I am back with Bill Richardson. We've been talking about all of my favorite stuff, movies, Darth Vader, Quentin Tarantino, not quite my favorite, but I do like his work, though. It's one of those things that had to grow on me. And we've been talking about writing and the process. I think the process is what fascinates me, Bill, about all of these things that go on. And another thing that fascinates me that you're deeply entrenched in, because you are a historian, is the Hatfields and McCoys. You know, I never realized, I watched your little video, and I never realized before today that they actually hunted down this guy because he fought for the wrong side in their minds in the Civil War. I did hear about the pig, though.
Yeah, a lot of people have heard about the pig. That's one of those cudgels that's been used on Appalachian peoples along with, you know, all the other ones. But, yeah, the Hatfields and McCoys, it's a really interesting story. It's 125 years old. There were feuds at the same time that were bigger and lasted longer and had more people killed. But that particular story is just hung in the minds of Americans for, you know, over a century. And it's a really, really rich, interesting story. It happened where I grew up, and you know, I became immersed in it, and I'm one of the foremost authorities in the world on it.
So why do you think we care more about this feud than other feuds?
Well, it has a little bit of everything. It has a love story. There's the sort of the Romeo and Juliet of the hills between the oldest boy in the Hatfields and the oldest girl in the McCoys, Jauncey and Rosanna. These people are very human. They have these, you know, these foibles and shortcomings. Somebody cuts you off in traffic and, you know, you have this instinct that rears up, I'd like to kill that person. Well, these people actually did that. So, you know, we see the humanity and the flaws in them. And, you know, it makes us feel good about ourselves that we're not quite that flawed. They encapsulated just a lot of the drama. You know, the story had, like I said, it's like a movie. It has so many different elements. And it was famous in its day. Devil Ance Hatfield, who was the head of the Hatfields, he appeared in a movie as himself. He was in a Wild West show. So, you know, even in its time, it was very famous. And as a friend of mine said, about every 10 or 20 years, it becomes famous again. And you know, people revisit that story again. But it's very, very rich. It's very, very rich story with amazing characters. And one of the things I say about writing when I'm talking to people about what makes writing last, it's the characters. You know,
absolutely.
Frankenstein and Dracula and Sherlock Holmes, we've re-engineered those and rewritten those for every generation. And the plots, you know, are no longer even thought about. People don't even know what the plots are for a lot of those things. But they do remember those characters. And the Hatfields and McCoys are like that. They've got these really, really interesting characters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the fact that they're basically our neighbors are just like you. They're like me. I think the biggest difference is that they act on their passion rather than just wishing it.
And those are the stereotypes about that story. And just like almost every story, you know, true story that you hear about, when you get into the details of it, you find out that a lot of those sort of the headlines or the stereotypical stuff aren't true. The Hatfields and McCoys, there were more legal proceedings than there were murders. And everybody thinks that these two families were like next door neighbors that lived across the river from each other. They were 6 hours apart.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And that's one of the things you find by being there in person, as I was. And anybody that's interested in history, go to the place where it happened, because you get a completely different picture of it. But, you know, that's one of the things about that's so wonderful about history, is that when you do get into the actual information instead of just what you've heard about, you know, it's been third hand, it's even more rich and interesting.
I'm sitting here thinking about the 6 hours. That's how long it used to take me to drive from my home in Florida to my mother's home in South Carolina. And, you know, by the end of the day, I was pretty much tired. And I'm driving a car, not a horse, not riding a horse. I'm not in a wagon. Now, are they still feuding today?
You know, honestly, what I tell people is the only thing the Hatfields and McCoys fight about anymore is the story. You know. Exactly. My granddaddy didn't do that. I actually have a good friend who I worked on a TV project with, who was a direct descendant. And he was like the great-great-grandson of Devil Lance Hatfield, the Hill Hatfields. And we were at the site where this event happened. And he said, I don't think he did. I don't think he killed those guys. Well, he absolutely killed those guys. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, because it was his family, he just couldn't get there. You know, he couldn't remove himself from that familial connection. So, you know, that's just the way we are.
Well, I think that's a good thing, too, because that shows loyalty to the family. And yeah, but there are some people, I think, in this world that have the opposite reaction. Oh, yeah, my granddaddy killed X number of people, either, you know, in the war or whatever. There's a certain pride in having an ancestor who was a man of action or whatever it happens to be.
And, you know, that's one of the things about being American is that we love the man of action. We love the person who kicks butt and takes names. That's why everybody likes an action movie. And the thing is, you don't really get to do that in real life. So that's the reason that you sort of live vicariously through that. You think, I would love to kick some butt and take some names, but I'd get fired if I did.
Yeah, you get fired. You get put in jail. You might get a divorce. Depends on whose butt you're kicking. I think that's why writers write the way they do. You know, that's where we pour out our angst and our anxiety sometimes. Now I'm wanting to sit down and write another book. I love it when ideas come to me like this.
Well, that's part of what storytelling is about, is that people want to live vicariously through those things. And they want to be able to have those experiences. I write a lot of scary books. And people a lot of times will ask me, well, why do you write that? Or why do people why do people consume that material? And it's because you get to be scared in a safe environment. And it's sort of like getting inoculated against, you know, the bad things in the world. You don't actually have to be, you know, threatened, but you get to experience that feeling of what would happen if I was. And so people, that's what people like movies and TV and books for, is to sort of live vicariously through those events. And they're usually, you know, they're not as complicated and messy and tough as life is.
Yeah. And, you know, I told you earlier that my son and I used to listen to audiobooks when we'd go on a road trip to the doctor or whatever. And the author that this was back in the day. I mean, my son's 40 now, so this was way before iPads and iPods and, you know, playlists. You had the cassette that you'd go stick in your car, weird stuff. But we would go to the library and pick out an audiobook, and it was almost always Dean Koontz, who wrote some really scary stuff. But it was in a supernatural sci-fi setting, so that it was set in real times, but it was a science fiction type creature that was doing the scary stuff. So it felt like, well, this could never happen to me. So it was very safe. Well, the same kid, you know, grown man, a few years ago, he and I share books all the time, and he handed me a stack of books, and I said, oh, you can keep these Stephen Kings. I'm not reading those. I don't like him. He said, Mom, you don't even know. You know what you think you know because you've seen a snippet of a cartoon or a commercial or a teaser of a horror movie. You should read his books. I said, I don't think I'm going to like it. He said, you're going to like it. Well, guess what? I liked it. So then I called him up. I said, you got any more Stephen King I can read? So, you know, reading is absolutely a safe place to get scared and to deal with your fears, and writing even more so. And you talked about, you know, I can't do that. I'd get fired. I'm working on a book of short stories about all the people that I want to kill. And whenever I get, I have a friend who calls them Mary's Tales of Mayhem. Well, that's not going to be the title of the book, but it helped me grieve after my mother died. I was very angry. And that is one of the, I don't know how many, there's a certain number of steps of grief you're supposed to go through. And, you know, you're sad, you're angry, you're something else. But I was very angry for a very long time. And I just thought, if I could just kill you. When somebody would say something that would trigger that grief in me, I didn't want to just kill them. I didn't want them to just die and disappear. I wanted them to die a horrible Quentin Tarantino type death. And so I started writing them, and I always find a way to make it so that it's very, there was a detective who came on the scene, that detective would be very perplexed at how this happened. So some of them look like accidents, and some of them are clearly not accidents. But it does help. It's very cathartic. And
yeah,
I don't know.
Absolutely. That,
I don't know if
that's,
writers
that's
are more or less sane than people who don't write.
I think, though, that's one of the reasons that writers write, is that it is cathartic. It is a way to get things out of you that are in there. And, you know, some of the best writing are people that do what you did. You know, there's this real thing in my life that is just like a thorn in my side, and I need to exercise that demon. And
yes.
That's some of the best writing you ever read is those people who are doing that.
Yeah, I think it's I would encourage anybody who may think they're not writers. Oh, you know, you hear this all the time. Oh, I'm not a writer. I can't write. Even if you think you don't know how to have the skill that it takes to create a book, you can write. If you learned how to spell your name, then you can put down two words together that can, you know, put down two words, put down two more words, put down three sentences, and get it out of your system. For me,
if you're intimidated by the writing process, just do a journal. Just sit down.
Yes.
And it's like you're writing a letter to just pick a person and write a letter to that person that talks about how you're feeling. And, you know, you don't have to show it to the world, but just that process of putting it on paper, it's really like exercising a demon. It really is. You can have, you know how you'll sleep at night and this one thought will go around in your head and around and around and around, and it just drives you crazy. What I do when that happens is I get up in the middle of the night and I write it down.
Yes, sir.
And then it's gone, and I go right back to sleep. And if I
and
don't
you sleep
do that,
like
it's just spinning through my head. Exactly. And so there's something about that process of writing something down. It's like you take the demon out of you and you put it on that piece of paper, and then it's out of you. And it's a very, very cathartic process, and it's a process that, you know, a lot of counselors and stuff will tell people to do. And so if you do have those things that are gnawing at you, write them down. Even if you never show them to anybody, even if you put them in a drawer, even if you burn the piece of paper when you're done, it can sort of exorcise that demon that has been inside of you.
And sometimes that works really well with troubled relationships. I did that with a family member that, you know, I just couldn't, as they say, I can't anymore. I didn't know what to do, because this was someone that I was related to, someone in the family. Can you divorce your cousin, your sister, your brother? You know, well, sure you can. You don't have to necessarily have a formal severing like in a marriage, but you can write down, I hereby divorce you, or I remove you from my life, or whatever you want to call it. And it, what's so funny is once I did this, I titled the file, delete. Delete me after you complete me, or something like that. And I spent a couple of hours writing all the things that annoyed me about this one person and all the things that I would do differently if this person was a different person. And I got to the end and I'm like, whew, I think I'm done. And I clicked the delete button. And I thought, surely I'm going to have problems afterwards because I deleted it. No, I don't. And the funny thing is this person has kind of just, I don't know if the person changed or I changed, but the relationship is better than it was. Still not
great, maybe,
but it's...
You know, that's again exercising those demons. And, you know, we get so hung up on, you know, things that annoy us. And it's hard to let those go. And what you did was you let it go. You just let it go into the world, and then you can move on from that. And, you know, one of the things you see in our society today is people just aren't letting stuff go. You know,
no,
people
they
don't
wanna
move
hold
on anymore.
Everything.
Yeah. People just don't move on. They want to continue, you know, chewing on that could. And, you know, there's a point where you just got to let that go and move on to the next thing.
All right, Bill, I'm going to ask you a question because you said chewing on the could. That tells me that you've got to know what this word means. A lot of people, when I say this word, they don't know what I'm talking about. But do you know what the word roughage is?
Roughage, yeah, of course I know what roughage is. Roughage is it's vegetable matter, basically. It's like when a cow chews any kind of grass or whatever, that's called roughage. And, you know, your doctor will tell you to eat more roughage, which means eat fibrous foods, which are plant-based.
I like you even more than I did 5 seconds ago. And I liked you a lot 5 seconds ago. Now, my husband, I went with my husband to the doctor, and if I hadn't been in there when this doctor said what he did, I wouldn't have believed it, because I was asking him, you know, well, I need to know what I should be feeding him. And the doctor gave me some weird answer. And I said, so basically no more roughage for a while? He goes, what's that? And he was a young doctor, so I'm good at giving him that credit. But I talked to other people, and they had no idea what roughage was. And I'm thinking, has that word gone out of usage? But you've restored my faith in humanity. You know what roughage is. So thank you. I think now would be the perfect time to listen to your audiobook.
All right. Let's listen to some rock and roll scary stuff.
Yeah.
Than Evil, written by Bill Richardson, read by Sky Soleil. Before, Gar ran through the woods as if the devil was chasing him. He didn't know if the things from the night were still following, but he was running as fast as he could, and looking back would only slow him down. Not far ahead, light flickered beyond the trees. Gar dropped into a steep ravine. The ditch was at the edge of the forest near his village. He scrambled up the other side and peered through a tangle of branches. What Gar saw was too horrible to believe. Most of the thatched-roofed huts were on fire, and leaping flames bathed everything in a blood-red glow. People were fleeing for their lives, and long scarecrow shadows pursued them as they went. The terrible creatures he had seen in the woods were already here. They'd overrun the village and were attacking anything that moved. Three of them pulled a frail old man from beneath a cart and began ripping the limbs from his body. A young woman bolted from one of the dwellings. She tripped over the carcass of a small child. The girl fell, and as she hit the ground, the carcass began crawling hungrily toward her. She got up and tried to run, but another of the creatures lunged. The broken blade of a lance protruded from the beast's head, but it seemed oblivious to the deadly wound and tore open the woman's throat with a flick of its misshapen hand. Blood shot into the air like a geyser, and the monstrosity buried its face in the horrible spray, wallowing in it as it drank. It gulped greedily, careless of how much was spilled, as if eating was secondary to the joy of the slaughter. The disgusting sight caused Gar to retch, and the burning eyes of the wounded creature turned in his direction. It discarded the woman like a forgotten toy and charged at him. Terrified, Gar tried to flee, but his legs became entangled and he fell back into the gully. The instant he hit bottom, he jumped to his feet and bolted for the darkened woods. Behind him, a pair of fiery eyes appeared at the top of the ravine. After a moment, another pair joined them, and another. Then the creatures rushed down from the forest like a ravenous storm. It had begun.
Holy moly. That's powerful.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, but it is creepy, but that's what you're going for, right?
Absolutely. That book, That's More Than Evil, and that's the audio version. There's a print version as well. It that book was about being just brutal. It's a real horror show. Not all my work is like that, but that particular book, I was trying to be just very, very in your face. And so, you know, you hear the blood spurting and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I did the prose book. And then when I got ready to do the audiobook, it was my first audiobook, I decided I want to do something different. I want to make the audiobook a different experience from reading the prose. And that was the reason that I created all that sound design and stuff that you know, that you hear in there, all the background stuff.
His voice and his enunciation it's perfect.
Sky Soleil is that guy's name. I found him. I looked for 6 months. Most of the narrators, you know, they do that sort of that guy that you hear in the thriller shows, you know, the thriller books. And I needed somebody that could bring a rural edge to it, but not take it so far that it sounded like a caricature. And he did an excellent job with that. Yeah, he's an actor. That was the first audiobook that he did.
It took me a second or two, or you know, a couple of his iterations, to realize that he was dropping the G on all the ing words. And I'm sitting there, I was really fascinated listening to him because he's just perfect for this story.
Well, the book is set in what I call deepest, darkest Appalachia. It's where I grew up. And it's Mingo County, West Virginia. It's on the West Virginia-Kentucky border. And it's a coal mining town. It's very isolated. It's central Appalachia. And, you know, it's a very rural place. And I needed somebody who would bring that rural edge to it, but not do it in a pejorative way. Most people that do rural things, they you know, they just mess it up by making a caricature. And he just really brought the feel of that. And, you know, he's a California guy. He's a Los Angelino. So he's just a tremendous talent. And like I said, that's his first audiobook. And so
find him?
It, you know, I went through hundreds of people. And he, in his reel, his sample reel, he had done a commercial for Coca-Cola in West Virginia. And I thought, well, that guy, you know, he did the right thing. He didn't bring too much, but he brought just enough. And I thought this guy could do this. And, you know, we figured out a way to make it happen. And he did an outstanding job. Sky Soleil is the guy's name.
Very impressive. I am. I'm actually blown away on this. And it's been a while since I've been blown away by an audiobook, but I like it.
Well, you know, horror is perfect for that rich sound design because atmosphere. That what people don't realize who watch films is how important the sound is. And one of the first experiences I had was working on a film, and a guy showed me the rough cut for a film that I had worked for, you know, months on, and it didn't have the sound design on it yet, and it was terrible. And I thought, oh, my God, I've worked so hard on this film, and it's just going to be horrible. And then the next time I saw that scene, he had added all the sound design to it, and it just brought it to life. And that taught me really on in my film career how, what you can do with sound. And so that was what I was trying to do with this audiobook, is to help, you know, set it apart in a way from, because most audiobooks don't do that. Most of them are just a reader, you know, reading them. But I wanted to do something that, you know, took it to a different level, and that was the reason for the sound design.
You did a good job with that. I'm definitely impressed. And, you know, I'm going to go back.
It was 4 months. The sound design alone was 4 months of 12-hour days.
Whoa. That's – now you put that on after he read or – what?
Yeah, what I would do is we the way that we work. Not everybody does this, but you know, he would do each chapter and send it to me, and then I would have notes, and then he would fix the issues that I had, and then usually that got us done, and then I took that, and he would go on and do the next chapter, and while he was doing the next chapter, the narration, I would be adding the sound design to other chapter. And so, you know, we just did that iterative process like that. And he was tremendous to work with. Sky was tremendous to work with. He was so good about saying, you know, well, let's do what we got to do to get this right. And it shows in the work. He did a tremendous job on that book.
Oh, hats off to both of you. Bravo. I want to say something before. We're kind of running out of time, but I am at your disposal if you want to continue talking. But I wanted to mention, you talked about how important sound is, the background sound, the atmosphere, and music too. But if you think about the two people we started talking about, James Earl Jones as Darth Vader, anybody who hears the Imperial March knows that Darth Vader is right around the corner.
Yeah.
And anybody, Steve Aoki is a techno musician, techno mixer, and he has a song out that he calls Tarantino. And it's all the sound bites from Quentin Tarantino's movies. And you hear these little bits and pieces of whatever, and you know you're immediately taken back to that movie. And if you can do that with your audio, I was watching your book as I was listening to it. The sound that you added, the squelching sound of that guy, the creature wallowing in the blood, just was like, oh my God, that's horribly good. It was so, it was really good, but great writing, man. Great writing.
Well, thank you. Writing is the purest form of storytelling. It's so good. It's just you and the page, and you don't have to worry about technicians or whatever. It's just you and the page, and so it is the medium. I've worked in almost all of them, and it is the one that I love the most.
I used to write poetry before I learned to dissect people with prose. And a dear friend of mine read all my poems, but they were written in a very dark time of my life, too. And he said, your poetry is so powerful. I can't wait to see what you do with prose. And I had to run and go look up the word prose because I couldn't tell him. I didn't know what it meant. But, I've been writing, as far as I know, all my life. I don't remember not. If I wasn't writing, I was reading or editing my cereal boxes. I don't remember not being a part of the writing process. And I think it's good for anybody who wants to get into it.
Well, you know, we have, there's, the thing is that most people are born with an innate something, you know, some talent or ability or desire.
Absolutely.
And you have that, but you also have to hone that. You also have to work on that and practice your craft. And that's what most people don't, end up not doing that part. But, you know, you see people with those talents, they go way back into their lives. It's like they're born with those things.
Yeah. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice,
yeah.
And it's the same with anything, whether you're a dancer, a musician, a filmmaker, in fact, Jennifer, my colleague at Be Unique, she was filming or photographing a wedding recently, and she wasn't feeling well. And I said, is this something you have to do, or can some, because I think she was filling in for another photographer that didn't show up or something like that. And I said, you know, if you're not feeling well, maybe we'll have to find, you know, they can find somebody else to do it. She said, no, I'm going to do it because I need to keep my skills sharp. And you do. Whether you're an illustrator, a photographer, or whatever, I don't even care if you're a street sweeper or a janitor. If you don't do it every day, you're not going to stay good at it.
Hey, Mary, the one thing we've not talked about is my new book. Could we take a few minutes to talk about that? Because I know we're getting sort of long into the show.
You go right ahead.
Well, the new prose book that I've got is Hellfighters, and it is a take on Lovecraft. One of the reviewers said it's like H.P. Lovecraft and Dan Brown had a baby. And there's a lot of truth in that. It's got a lot of action. There's sort of a puzzle to solve. But it also is it's cosmic horror. It's weird horror. It deals with these, you know, evils that are so big that they're difficult for the mind to grasp. And you know, there's people who like H.P. Lovecraft and people who don't. But what this does is it plays in that sandbox, but it does it for a modern audience in a way that that is a lot of action and is just a really, really fun read. And the story is basically about a guy named Max Heller, who's this professor, and he sort of paints himself into an employment corner, and he has to take this job at a small university in this remote part of Massachusetts. And he discovers this place in the woods near there where the normal rules of physics and the world don't apply. And Max's arc is that he spent his whole life using his mind is the tool that he uses, you know, to survive and get through the world. And he stumbles upon something that logic just can't solve. And so he has to become, you know, this sort of man of action to be able to figure, you know, to be able to take on this challenge. And it's just a really fun book. The More Than Evil, what we listened to the clip of before, that is a very, you know, sort of visceral book. Hellfighters is less of that. It's, you know, it's rock and roll and a lot of action, but it's not real bloody or anything like that. And it's just, it's a book that it works on so many different levels. It's an action story. There's also some, you know, sort of things that you've got to solve intellectually. It has some of this really psychedelic writing in it in places. You see the Big Bang from outside of it.
Wow.
There's even some scientific things that sort of to sort of challenge you. There's an alternative to string theory called E8 as another explanation for how the world and the universe works. And it's not heady or anything like that. It's not boring, you know, math and that sort of stuff. It's just in there to show you that all the things that you think you know about the world, you don't. The guy next door is not who you think he is. And the world does not work the way you think that it does. And that's sort of the underlying, you know, theme and process of that story. And it's a book that's got tons of 5-star reviews. And it's one that I'm really, really proud of.
Well, it sounds like a good book. It sounds like it's got a little bit of everything in there. I don't remember hearing you say anything about romance, though.
You know, it toys with that, and that's probably one of my weaker areas is that I don't have enough romance in my books. But this book, it sort of strings you along, and that's what I tend to do is that delayed gratification when it comes to romance. You know, you think in More Than Evil, the book that we talked about, the audiobook, there's romance is, you know, the whole thing is that the main character is trying to save the woman he loves. that's the entire, you know, spine of that story. But there's a little bit of romantic tension in Hellfighters as well.
Good. Then you've got something for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, you are a delightful storyteller. I'm glad this worked out that we could talk tonight. Did you have anything else you should touch on?
No, I mean, those are the projects that are out there right now, Hellfighters and More Than Evil. I've got another book that's a mid-grade reader called The Frankenstein Adventures, which is for, you know, kids in middle school, basically. And I've got some things in the works. I'll have something out in September, but right now I've got several books that I'm trying to get to the point where they're ready to get out there and share with folks.
Very cool. Now, how can people find you? I know that you've got a page on Amazon.
Right. I'm Bill Richardson and BillRichardson.com, and it's Bill with one L, so it's B-I-L Richardson. So it's BillRichardson.com is my website, and then I've got of course, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all those. And then you'll find a lot of my work on I've got an Amazon author page. And then, of course, there's, you know, audiobooks out there on Audible as well.
I think I can just type your name in and throw a rock and hit you, probably.
Well, you know, there's another Bill Richardson out there who was governor of New Mexico, and he was in the Clinton administration and several others. And if you do two L's, he shows up for pages and pages. But so there's a little difference there. But if it's Bill Richardson with one L, you'll probably catch hold of me.
No, we don't need that annoying second L hanging around.
Yeah.
And you don't need a keychain with your name on it either, do you?
No. But the one thing about that you'll find about my work is that my number one rule is don't be boring. And so I try to keep people entertained. I try to move quickly. And I love page turners to read them, and I love to write them.
Well, if your audio is anything like your book, or I said that backwards, if your book is anything like your audio, and why wouldn't it be, you know? You just put your own sound effects, you can read the book, and it would definitely be a page turner.
Well, that's the goal.
I was kind of hoping the audio clip was more than 3 minutes long.
Well, go out there on Audible and you can read it all.
I will. Thank you. I appreciate you calling in tonight, and I appreciate you sharing your stories with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I've had a blast. I hope folks will listening have had a good time, and I hope they'll go out and check out the stuff. And let's do this again sometime.
I will. I don't know when I'm coming back on. Like I said earlier, I fill in for Tony, mainly because Tony started filling in for me to give me a break, and now I'm giving him a break. So, you know, one hand washes the other. But definitely, I'd love to have you come back on, maybe after September when you finish that other project.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening this evening. We're happy you chose to spend this time with us, and we hope you learned as much as we did.
Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And if you'd like us to invite you or someone you know to speak right here, just go to beunique.org and contact us there.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that our newly branded podcast has so many global listeners and that our website and magazine receive thousands of visitors each month. Let's put your brand in front of all those people. Mary can share the demographics with you. Contact her through the website. That's BUNEKE.org.